Today is the fifth day of our July-August seven-day session, 3rd of August 2017. And today we're going to take up a story from The Hidden Lamp, Stories of 25 Centuries of Awakened Women, edited by Florence Kaplow and Susan Moon. This is a book that is attempting to restore the balance a bit. So much of the information we have about our ancestors is about men, and very little is about women. And so this book has gathered together stories from throughout Buddhist history of women masters, and presented them in one volume. Part of the reason why we don't have a lot of material on female Zen masters or other teachers is simply because the history writing has tended to be in the hands of men, and the record keeping, and either the records of were just not taken, or if a woman's teachings were written down, and we know that this was the case in some cases because there are reference to these books in other records, that the material wasn't preserved. It wasn't considered important enough to preserve, because you can imagine these texts need to be cared for if they're going to last through the centuries. So the book includes actual koans, some of which appear, a few of which appear in our koan collections that we work on, and then some other stories are koan-like, kind of mondo exchanges, with one or other of the protagonists having an insight. But then there are also just more conventional stories and anecdotes about ancient and modern women as well. Not all Zen, really. These stories have been taken from the whole spectrum of Buddhism, including ancient India. And in Auckland, we've put together a new chant. And many of the women who appear in this book are included in this chant, which is called the Pool of Radiance chant. It's modelled on one that has been done in Sweden for over 10 years. We've updated it a bit and reworked it. But we're going to start chanting this soon, and we'll do it alongside the ancestral line. So we're not going to stop doing our regular ancestral line, which is important because it is our particular family tree, so to speak. We continue to do that one, both the short and the long ancestral line, but we're going to start doing this Pool of Radiance chant as well. And this to distinguish it from the ancestral line, it goes backwards. So we start with Roshi Kaplow, and we end with Prajnaparamita, the mother of the Buddhas. And in between we have a whole bunch of Japanese women, Chinese women, Indian women, but also male teachers from mostly from China, but also from Japan, who are meaningful to us. So because our line is a lot of the names in our ancestral line, we don't have a lot of stories about these figures. So we're in the new chant, we also include familiar figures such as Joshu and Rinzai and others. So the whole thing is made up to 108 names, so it's quite long. And since a lot of the names are Chinese, it's quite a challenge. It has been quite a challenge to prepare decent guides to pronunciation, so we can get our lips around these difficult Chinese names. But anyhow, in preparation for launching this chant, and it's been in preparation for quite a while, periodically in Taisho we've been exploring the stories of some of the women who are going to be in the chant. So once we start doing this chant, we're going to remove the line in our regular ancestral line which talks about unsung women, because they'll no longer be unsung. And it is important, I think, that for all of us, both women and men, that we know these stories. Because they do offer a different perspective on things. One that I have found refreshing. And really, I've enjoyed looking into these stories. Partly just because there's less material around them, so there's a kind of freshness to coming to them. You don't have that sense of the weight of their having been interpreted by great masters for centuries and centuries, and don't have all these stern fathers with their arms crossed looking down on you while you give the talk. So it's been a pleasure for that reason. And the topic that the story that we're going to take up today is called Shotaku's Paper Sword. And just to mention that each sword and each story in this volume is made up of three parts. So there's the story itself, short usually, and then the editors have invited a contemporary female teacher for each story to write a fairly short commentary on the story. And among the many teachers writing in this book, Mitra and Sunya Roshi's, and I contributed a commentary too. So our own lineage is quite well represented. And then the final thing in each section is a few little questions that are posed by the editors of the book. And just to say a little bit about Florence Kaplow and Susan Moon. Florence Kaplow is a Soto Zen priest in the Suzuki Roshi lineage, and she's also practiced Vipassana, and she's also a field botanist, an essayist, an editor, and a blogger. And her writing is spread in a number of Buddhist journals. And then Susan Moon has a long-time practitioner at the Berkeley Zen Center, 35 years plus, and she received entrustment as a lay teacher from Zoketsu Norman Fisher. And among her books, one called This Is Getting Old, Zen Thoughts on Aging. She edited Turning Wheel, the Buddhist Peace Fellowship magazine, for many, many years. And my favourite is of her writings is The Life and Letters of Tofu Roshi, which I once read on an aeroplane going back to New Zealand, and became quite embarrassed because I was laughing out loud so much while I was reading it. So just to reread our story, Shotaku's Paper Sword. Shotaku was the third abbess of the Tokeiji convent. One evening she was returning to Tokeiji from a nearby monastery when a man armed with a sword accosted her and threatened to rape her. She took out a piece of paper, thrust it like a sword at the man's eyes, and thrust it like a sword at the man's eyes. He was completely overcome by her spiritual strength and was unable to strike her. He turned to run, and she gave him a Zen shout, hitting him and knocking him down with her sword. He fled. So just to some background information. So first a little bit on Tokeji, which is a very interesting place. Tokeji still exists. It's a Buddhist temple, and is a former Rinzai Zen nunnery in Kamakura, and it's a sister temple to one that people may have heard of, Engakuji. And Tokeji was founded in 1285 by the bhikkhuni Kakuzan Shido. So 1285, that's is it 32 years after the death of Dogen. So Tokeji became a refuge for women. Under Japanese law, women were not allowed to divorce their husbands, though men could divorce their wives. And so women who were in abusive relationships would seek sanctuary in Tokeji. And for 600 years, no men were allowed to enter the inner cloister of Tokeji except for certain special ceremonies when the abbot of the Enkakuji might be invited. So if women were in an impossible situation of marriage, they had this option that if they could get themselves into Tokeji and stay there for 3 years, they could be freed from their marriage. And this became a recognized thing. So if their husbands were being unfaithful, or if they were being unfaithful and they wanted to be able to marry their lover, they could do this. So you can understand that you would have to really love somebody to be willing to spend 3 years in a tough Rinzai Zen temple in order to be able to marry them. It's pretty good proof of your sincerity to do that. The abbesses of Tokeji were often the daughters of aristocrats or even of related to the emperor, and no doubt this association would have helped to protect the women of Tokeji. They had this kind of backing of powerful people that enabled this place to run in this fashion, because there would have been a lot of people who would have been against this, especially the husbands of the wives who might have fled into Tokeji. The other name for Tokeji was Kakekome-dera, which actually means run to temple. And you can imagine women might have to actually run to get there before being caught and taken back. Tokeji was also known as, and was famous for, developing a really new, unique form of Zen training, which is called Mirror Zen. And what it involved was a woman would actually sit in Zazen in front of a large mirror. And then as she sat there doing Zazen, she would look deeply into the image and ask, where is a single feeling, a single thought in the mirror image into which I gaze? Where is a single feeling, a single thought in the mirror image into which I gaze? And the purpose of this practice was to kind of deconstruct the practitioner's attachment to her physical self-image, whether that self-image might be by positive or negative. And you have to understand how this would have played out at the time and through history in Japan. Society would value a woman according to her appearance, and women were taught, conditioned to believe that their physical beauty was their most important attribute. And you have to say that beauty would seem to largely have determined a girl's fate in that kind of environment. But we don't need to completely talk in the past tense about this. If you think even now, if you look at the multi-million-dollar cosmetic industry, obviously this is something women are still conditioned to put a lot of energy and money into. And of course today we also have the incredible pressure on girls that comes from the kind of physical beauty that is portrayed through advertising and Hollywood films and Photoshop Facebook images. There's incredibly high standards of beauty and specific body shapes that young women are supposed to emulate. And of course what this leads to, this has been written about a lot, is the strong conviction among many girls that they're not good enough. So a special practice here to start to examine this whole question of selfhood. And this mirror that there would be used for this was large. It was about 6 foot across and had come from a Shinto temple. So if you're sitting, it was round. So if you were sitting in Zazen in front of this mirror, you would be able to see your whole body sitting there. Writer Grace Shiason, who wrote a book called Zen Women, she compared this practice of sitting looking into the mirror she said it was like a parallel practice for women to the traditional practice that has been done by monks right since the time of the Buddha, where the monks would go to graveyards or charnel grounds and meditate on corpses, and preferably on female corpses. And the idea was that by doing this and really examining the nature of the body in all its different stages of decay, that the monk would deconstruct or see through his sexual desires. So it was aimed to get the monks to look beyond the surface, beyond the beautiful skin, to what was underneath, and so start to break down his attachments to and fantasies about the female body. So in the mirror practice, rather than somebody else's body, it was one's own body. And also not only the body itself, but one's feelings and attitudes towards one's own physical experience. another book that came out a few years ago on Buddhist women, the author Sally Tisdale sort of fictionalizes the story of how this practice came into existence, and it was invented by the founder of the temple, and here's how Sally Tisdale imagines that she might have come up with it. She looked at the mirror every day as she walked to and from the meditation hall, and then one day she stopped and sat in Zazen right in front of it. After that, she moved her cushion into the mirror hall and did all her meditation there. It was curious. She had done a lot of Zazen. She'd had Inca and deep understanding, and she had at times felt as though everything was clear all the way through. Clear, clear to the bottom. But in front of the mirror, her mind kept flitting, resting, and flitting away like a moth in the garden, like the sparrow whose head is never still. She looked in the mirror and saw, what? Nothing. Everything. Her own face and body. She looked in the mirror and noticed her eyes flitting, her hands trembling a little, her posture shifting every few moments. She looked in the mirror and tried to be still, to hold the gaze of her own eyes perfectly still, unmoving like a statue. She tried to be like a picture. She tried to sit like a tree, like a rock, like a dream. She knew how to hold herself still and bright and relaxed and upright and serene and strong all at once. She knew, but in front of the mirror it was very difficult. Finally, with eyes open and seeing herself, she could hold herself utterly still and soft just for a moment. After that, her mind began to relax and move less, flit less often and less quickly. She began to see through the reflection, through the skin and the eyes and the face and the reflection, to see nothing, empty, full. The mirror was clear, clear as water, clear as air, clear as the sky, clear as the truth. No dust could alight. And then Shido wrote a poem to express her understanding. And the version in this text goes as follows. If the mind never rests on a single thing, nothing can be clouded. No need to speak of polishing. And some people may pick up the reference here. It goes way back to Hui Neng, the sixth ancestor. And there's this the story of when Hui Neng was at the fifth ancestor Hung Ren's monastery, and Hung Ren knew what Hui Neng's potential was, but and wanted to appoint him to as his successor, but couldn't because he was a layman and a southerner, and there was all this prejudice against him in the temple. And so to set in train a process, he set up this test where he invited people to express their understanding. And so only one dared to do so. It was the head monk. And the head monk's verse of expressing his understanding got written on a wall, and it went as follows. The body is the Bodhi tree. The mind is like a mirror bright. Take heed and keep it always clear, and don't let the dust alight. And the story goes that Hui Neng, who couldn't read or write, got somebody to read out the poem for him, and then when he heard it, he realized that this monk's understanding was only went so far, and he produced his own poem and asked somebody to write it on the wall next to the first poem. And Hui Neng's poem was, there is no Bodhi tree nor stand of mirror bright. From the first there is not a single thing, So where can dust alight? So these poems really are behind the founder of Tokeji's poem, and another translation from another source fits in the same kind of meter as follows: Since not a single thing takes lodging in the mind, it is untainted. To speak of polishing is itself illusion. So deep roots for this mirror practice, this practice of learning to go beyond appearances. Everyone, all of us, we come to practice with our own history, with things that we find painful and oppressive, even hopeless. And we can imagine how the people, the women who came to Tokeji, must have felt. By society, at least, to fail as a wife, in terms of society's values, to fail as a wife was really to fail as a human being, and to be branded as a fallen woman or damaged goods. So these women would have a lot to work against when they came into the temple. It would be really urgently necessary for them to see beyond their own self-image, and we can be sure that it wouldn't just be them thinking this was the how society saw them, because we internalize these ways of seeing, and we believe them. We think they're true, that they define us. Even though they're imposed upon us by family, by society, by history, we feel them personally. So for these women, it would be an urgent question: what is it that remains undefiled? What is it that remains pure and clear and free? In Confucian culture, the place of women was, you really had three options only. Either you were being ruled over by your father or by your husband, and when you reached old age, by your son. So these women coming into Tokeji would have probably felt adrift, and they'd be having to find their way. So back to our story. Oh, actually, a little bit before we look at the story more closely, just a little bit about Shotaku, the protagonist in the story. Her lay name was Sawa. And she married a samurai of quite high status, Sakurada Sadakuni, who was a major retainer of the Hojo family, one of the powerful families at the time. And it was a time of much unrest and war, and Sakurada was killed in 1331. And at that point, Sawa shaved her head and entered Tokeji. That was when it first started. It wasn't considered to be the divorce temple, but it was set up with the purpose of being a place of refuge. And in the beginning, it was mainly widows who would come there, or other women who had somehow been rejected from society. So when Sawa came and entered Tokeji, she was ordained and took the name Shotaku. And then she practiced for many years under Dasen, who was the master and the 17th abbot of... second abbot of Engakuji. She later became the third abbess of Tokeji. So going back to our story, one evening Shotaku was returning from Tokeji. The two temples are on opposite sides of a gorge, and the nuns would go across down into the gorge and up the other side to Engakuji to go to Doksan with their teacher, Daisen. And so Shotaku would have been returning from one of these visits. It's probably 9 or 10 at night after the evening sitting, and she was gone down into this dark ravine, and then would have to cross across the gorge and up the other side to her temple. And as she was walking down this steep ravine, she was accosted by this man brandishing a sword and commanding that she get down so that he could take his pleasure. And she just, in that moment, she whipped the scroll out of her sleeve, which actually was the scroll containing a verse that her teacher had given her to work on. And she just thrust the scroll at the man. And he was so surprised by this and at the energy with which she did it that he couldn't strike her. And then she shouted and whacked him with her rolled up piece of paper, knocked him down. And then you can imagine at that point she probably made a quick exit, her heart pounding. In the literature it said that she had cultivated her ki. It doesn't say how she did this, what her practice was, whether she had perhaps practiced a martial art as a young woman, or if it was simply something that came from her zazen. This was a Rinzai temple, and still today in the Rinzai there's a breath practice which very much focuses on cultivating the ki energy in the hara. This is what Harada Roshi, who we were reading from earlier in Sesshin, teaches. It gathers the energy in the tanden, or the hara region. So all this energy that emerged in this moment, and her paper sword was able to fend off a man with a real sword, a sword of steel. Each of these stories comes with a commentary, and I'd like to read a little bit of the commentary that's given here. It's a story, really, and this is by Nancy Mujo Baker, and she is a Dharma heir of Bernie Glassman Roshi, and is a member of the Zen Peacemakers Order, as well as being a philosophy professor, and she lives in New York City. This is what she writes. The story about Shotaku reminds me of a news item that came out of Somalia last year about a remarkable woman doctor, Dr. Hawa Abdi, who runs a small hospital that she built on her own land. It's the only hospital for miles around. One day she heard gunshots. A warlord and his men had surrounded the hospital with guns drawn. They belonged to one of Somalia's most fearsome militant groups, notorious for chopping off hands and stoning adulterers. "Why are you running this hospital?" they demanded. "You are old and you're a woman." She was held at gunpoint while the hospital was ransacked and severely damaged by the warlord's underlings. She was then put under house arrest for 5 days while the hospital was shut down. In that time, 24 malnourished children from the hospital died. But then something extraordinary happened. Hundreds of women from the sprawling refugee camp on Dr. Abdi's property dared to protest, adding to a flood of condemnation from Somalis abroad that forced the government to back down. Because of so much publicity about their misdeeds, they agreed to open the hospital again. But Dr. Abdi refused until the warlords apologized in writing. They did, in both English and Somali. In their document, they apologized to Dr. Abdi, to the NGOs helping in the camp, to the camp staff, and to the Somali people around the area who had lost loved ones. And she goes on, Nancy Mujo Baker goes on to say that it's just another marvelous example of spiritual strength. And then she asks, what exactly is spiritual strength? And she says, in this Zen story, with the Zen shout and a would-be rapist being overcome by Shotaku, it is easy to romance or idealize some mysterious Zen thing called spiritual strength, as if it is possessed only by enlightened ones, whoever they are. But Dr. Abdi's story brings this idea down to earth, here and now, and challenges us in a realistic way to ask if we could do what she did. Actually, we all have the strength. It's the same strength we use whenever we commit ourselves to something completely. An example would be skiing downhill with one's whole body and mind, 100%. It is, on many ski slopes, the only way to avoid breaking a leg. If I ever had to have brain surgery, I would hope that my surgeon could be 100% in this way. It is hard for us to do something, anything, 100%, especially when it involves others. We are usually worried about making a mistake. Do we look right? Will be approved of? Will we offend someone? And in this koan and in the story from Somalia, we might also be worried about whether we would be killed. We are completely tied to others for reference points to assure us that we are solid, separate, and permanent. We resist doing anything 100% because it involves giving up those reference points and thus our self, something that we are very reluctant to do. At a certain point, having heard over and over again that the whole point in Zen practice is to give oneself 100%, at a certain point I realized I didn't know what that was, because really I had never actually given myself 100%. And no one can tell you what it is. It's something you can know only from actually doing it. And the thing is that when we do give ourselves 100%, we disappear. but not in the sense of going into some nothingness, but in the sense that we become simply whatever we're doing, whatever we're saying. Not only that, but the people who are hearing and the space we're in. We disappear into things as they are. Thinking about it, all kinds of anxiety can come up. But when we actually do it, it's liberating. And we can train ourselves to go back again and again to that place of disappearance. As no doubt Shotaku had in his Zen training. When this happened, she had been going for years and years in to sit before her teacher at Engakuji. This was a tough Rinzai Zen temple. So she probably went hundreds of times before her teacher and was wrung out. Of course, it takes courage to do that. Not only courage to face up to our own limits of many kinds, but to do so publicly, in front of others, in front of the teacher. Doksan really, really constellates all our issues, all the issues we have around self and other. They come up to the surface through the process of going to Doksan. And for many of us, these things are painful. A lot of us have had painful experiences from school or from home with teachers or parents that can have really shaped the way that we experience the world and ourselves and others. Years ago, there was someone who was here in training. And he told me a story. This is something that had happened to him when he was 4 or 5, maybe. And he found a kitten somewhere outside in the woods, and he was delighted by this little furry creature, and he wanted to keep the kitten, and. So he thought the best thing is if he tied it up and then went and got his dad, and then he could show his dad this cute little kitten and maybe he'd be allowed to keep it. And so he put a string around the cat's neck and tied the string to the tree and went off to try and find his dad. And when they came back, he had to interrupt his dad at work or something like that. He wasn't all that pleased about this, a bit grumpy and coming with his kid. They come back and they find that the kitten had pulled on the string and was being choked by the string in quite a lot of distress. And then when his father tried to extricate the cat from the string, the cat went wild and started biting and scratching. And then the father just turned to the son. And I don't remember now exactly what he said, but he was basically cursing at him for doing such a stupid thing, because he'd got angry by the fact that he was being scratched and bitten. And this event at that age where the little boy's tender feelings from this cat were completely negated and destroyed by the father's reaction, still paining him years and years, years later. So it takes a lot of courage for us to really face these kinds of conditionings. They're known in Buddhism, samskaras, mental formations, powerful mental formations, through which we experience the world. And Zen practice really involves stepping into the void, going beyond the safety and familiarity of the known. Even if it's negative, this is one of the ironies, that we cling to these things even though they're incredibly painful, because at least they are familiar. At the end of this story, the editors pose these questions. And in the case of this story, they ask, a Zen teacher once said that even if you weren't a bodhisattva yet, you could pretend to be one. What is the significance of imagination on the spiritual path? Can you overcome fear by pretending to be brave? I think of that saying, fake it until you make it. To go into Dzogchen and just present yourself, whatever that means in that moment. If you're got some question or something that's coming up that is alive for you, then just to risk it, put it out there. Or if you're giving a demonstration, to throw yourself into that, be willing to make a fool of yourself. Often the most valuable dzogchens. But to commit. Commit 100%. Each of us has to find out what 100% means for him or herself. We'll stop here and recite the four vows. All beings without number, I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate
the great way of Buddha, I vow.